So now I'm gonna stand on the strength of the shoulders of those who stand up and never back down.
The Winnipeg General Strike wasn't just a labor story. That whole period was just a boiling cauldron of labor issues, race issues, economic calamity. So it's dramatic as hell.
It's been described as Norma Rae meets Hamilton. The new film Stand, set during the 1919 general strike in Winnipeg, Canada, features an immigrant Romeo and Juliet battle for love and a better life during a time of social upheaval not unlike our own. Producer and composer Danny Scher talked about it with the New York State AFL-CIO's podcast, Union Strong. By the way, you can catch a free screening of Stand by the DC Labor Film Fest this Tuesday night, and I'll be doing a live Q&A after the film with Danny, the film's director, and one of the film's stars. We've got a link to RSVP in the podcast notes. Hope to see you then.
The plaza at Union Square wasn't designed for labor demonstrations and labor protests, but it very quickly became co-opted by the New York City unions.
In part two of her talk on skyscraper labor and the places of labor protest, architectural historian Joanna Merwood-Salisbury turns to Union Square in New York City and the movement to improve working conditions for garment industry workers in New York's commercial lofts in the early 20th century. It's a really fascinating talk that I hope helps us to look at the buildings in our own cities and think not only about the people who work there now, but who struggled and fought for their rights in the past. By the way, Joanna's talk includes lots of great old photos, which you can see if you check out the original video. We've got a link in the show notes. As usual, we wrap up the show with labor history in two.
The year was 1898. That was the day workers in the textile mills of New Bedford, Massachusetts, walked out on strike.
Rick Smith tells us about standing against wage theft more than a century ago. I'm Chris Garlock. And that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show.
For the New York State AFL-CIO, I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. It's been described as Norma Rae meets Hamilton, a union movie about a union story with a love story woven throughout. It's called Stand and is the number one Canadian movie musical that's now available in U.S. theaters virtually. On the phone with me to talk about the film is co-producer Danny Scher. Danny, welcome to the Union Strong podcast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So I introduced you as co-producer, but I know you also, you wrote the film, music, lyrics, and score, which is impressive.
Thanks. Yeah, I juggle a few hats. My favorite hat is composer, but just shows what you got to do to get a movie made. So I became producer too.
Well, I watched the movie last night and I loved it. The music, you've got songs in there that really stick in your head. So I think that says a lot about the quality of the music and what you put into it. So this is a film based on a true story from 1919 that really covers the core of what drives workers to stand up and fight for better wages and better working conditions, a better life. But this movie is about more than that. Can you give our listeners an idea of the story behind this that you're telling with Stand?
Sure. So as you say, it's set in 1919 and it's set in my city. I'm in Winnipeg, Canada, which for those who don't know is 4 hours directly north of Fargo, but just across the American-Canadian border. So in 1919, just like Seattle in February of that year, in May of that year, we had a general strike that lasted 6 weeks and that really changed the history of the country. I won't go into too much detail, but suffice to say, we have a third party, unlike the United States with a party on the right and a party on the left, we have a party further to the left than the centrist liberal party called the National Democratic Party. It sprung from the events of 1919. So just really wide-ranging historic outcomes from that strike, especially to labor. This is a story of biblical proportions to labor. And what I point out to people is that it's like the Alamo to the United States. The Winnipeg General Strike wasn't just a labor story. That whole period was just a boiling cauldron of labor issues, race issues, economic calamity. So it's dramatic as hell.
It is. And you mentioned Seattle from 1919 with the general strike. Mm-hmm. And so it's set up that same idea. You're right after the war. You've got soldiers are back. They're trying to go to their old jobs, which is how your movie starts out.
Those are our jobs.
We don't have a choice. We have to work where the government tells us or they deport
us. Sokolowski, you working or what?
And right away, there's an issue because these companies are willing, more than willing, to take in the immigrants rather than the soldiers returning because they're going to work for far less money, which is what how things start out.
Yep. And I point out that 1919 was the summer of general strikes mm-hmm. all across the world because of the economic calamity of the post-war era, and inflation was crazy. And so everybody was starving. And then you add to that this return of the veterans from the First World War. And this is the summer that became the Red Summer. I thought that was a reference to a transplanting of the Bolshevik Russian Revolution and a reference to red communists. Well, it wasn't, I found out. It was because all of the blood that was being shed that summer in the United States, there were 26 white supremacist riots. The soldiers that returned in those particular cities, largely the North, but then increasingly through the South, they returned to have those from the black community, mostly in the southern states that had migrated with the Great Migration to the North, seeking jobs and who had received jobs during the Second World War, now confronted with returned soldiers who wanted their jobs back. What we portray in the particular scene in Stand is a bunch of non-black immigrants who encounter the same situation. So it was brutal.
And I thought it was interesting early on when they're starting to talk about it's time to stand up and to fight for better wages. You have, I think it's not Rebecca. It's who's the woman who's playing?
Helen Armstrong is, I believe, who you're referring to, the female labor activist.
And so is that true to the story? It was a woman who got everybody together for that first meeting? Because I thought that was interesting that it was a woman.
Yeah, great until now. Unreported story was the degree of female activists who mobilized whole neighborhoods. They went neighborhood by neighborhood, just as depicted in the movie. And Helen Armstrong, the hair in my arms is going up right now. She's just the most inspiring person from Canadian labor history. Look her up. It turns out she's buried in Los Angeles because towards the end of her life, she moved with her daughter to live there, passed away there, is buried there. But look her up. They called her the Wild Woman of the West. She was like decades ahead of her time. When some in the female activist community were advocating for female suffrage, for women to be able to vote, mm-hmm. they were simultaneously still advocating for sterilization of some undesirable classes of society, read immigrant women. In that climate, Helen Armstrong was saying, this is so wrong. So she was very much on the right side of history, literally 50 to 60 years ahead of her time. And what's depicted in the movie is just about exactly what she was doing. And I used many of her words from her many recorded speeches.
Sir, what I have to say affects all of you. Like all workers in this city, you're paid next to nothing. Prices have doubled, but your wages have not.
Oh, that was powerful. And then
your
you had Emma. She's the refugee from racist violence in Oklahoma. And this was something that you added on later to this film. Tell me about that and how that came about.
So we hired a Canadian director with much experience with musical movies, but usually musical dance movies. He was born in Sudbury, which you may know is a major steel town and a major United Steelworkers town. Robert's dad came from Nigeria, married a white German woman, and worked at USW in Sudbury. So Robert had that whole union background. He grew up as a person of mixed race in Canada. He's just like the perfect director ever. His first read of the film, he said to me, "Dan, this story is incredible, but it's really white. We just got to get some representation because you've just missed a whole chunk of the story, which is there were black people in Winnipeg. And there were indigenous people." So he said immediately, "Let's see which characters we can make more representative." That very day was February 1st, 2017, which is the start of Black History Month. I went to Black History Canada Month. Boom, there's a story that I read and I'm shaking my head. I like to consider myself a decent amateur historian. And I had completely missed how the Great Migration didn't end at that U.S. border that's just an hour south of us. Many people from Oklahoma, for example, went to Winnipeg and then west to Regina and Edmonton and Calgary. There was a First World War all-black regiment in Edmonton, in Alberta. So then I checked the census, and one-third of the quote-unquote help in the wealthy part of town was black. This is the women who were domestics while their husbands worked as rail porters. That's the only job that black men could have at that time that was unionized, that paid better. So the character of Emma Jones, the emigre from Oklahoma, was born.
"My family came from Oklahoma 10 years ago, running from lynchings. My husband died fighting for this country. But now, they up and change the law. You got this color skin, and they don't let you in no more."
She's played by Lisa Bell, who's a Winnipegger. And as I'm sure you'll agree, and viewers that watch the movie will as well, she's just jaw-droppingly good. And she sings the title song.
Another scene that stands out to me is when they're all in jail together, and there's another great song, and the black men are talking about your concern. He's referring to the white people from Ukraine and others that they're worried about deportation and what some of what they face. Tell me about that scene. That's a great one, too.
So that's our sort of nod to Black Lives Matter. That song has been in the musical since 2005 when I wrote it. And I should point out that the stage musical on which the movie is based is called Strike. When I wrote the song Stand, Robert, the director, was like, "We gotta call the movie Stand," and that just stuck. But that song, and it's called Better the Days, it's been in the show right from the beginning since 2005 when it was a stage musical called Strike. But we changed the lyrics and had this great scene set up inside a jail where once there were black people present singing those words, it just became completely apparent. White people are not aware that in worrying about being deported, the black people are like, "Are you kidding me? Come to our side of the track sometime and see how we're being mistreated by the police."
"If you sneeze, deport him. Dirty knees, deport him. Didn't say please, deportable sleeves. Stung by bees, deport him. Late with fees, deport him. Watered some trees, deportable disease. Deport him, someone please.
Better the day, so hope."
So that song and scene becomes a little metaphor, well, quite a big one, for Black Lives Matter.
And I wondered about that throughout. Do you think that this is relatable today?
Oh my God, I wish I could say I'm such a great writer that I put all this stuff in on purpose, but it's an accident of history that the circumstances of 1919 are so close to today. And, you know, what happened on January 6th in BC, I mean, we're showing a guy from 1919 who has his own little Twitter account. He controls a newspaper and he bashes out these really provocative and absolutely factually incorrect headlines that his followers take for gospel truth. He has a private extrajudiciary army, in effect, the white armband wearing specials. This is an actual thing from history, from the strike. They did the bidding of this particular character from history and in the movie and acted as a sort of private vengeance army. The parallels just grow closer daily.
Thanks for listening to the Union Strong podcast. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe and give us a rating. This has been a production of the New York State AFL-CIO. Our president is Mario Salento. Our secretary treasurer is Terry Melvin. We're a federation of 3,000 unions representing 2.5 million union members, retirees, and their families with one goal: to raise the standard of living and quality of life of all working people. We keep New York State Union strong by fighting for better wages, better benefits, and better working conditions. For more information on the labor movement in New York, visit nysaflcio.org. Until next time, stay union and stay strong.
You can catch a free, that's right, free screening of Stand by the DC Labor Film Fest this Tuesday night. I'll be doing a live Q&A after the film with Danny Schur, the film's producer and composer, as well as the director of the film and one of the film's stars. We've got a link to RSVP in the podcast notes.
It isn't illegal to speak one's mind in this country.
Then make it illegal.
If you go, Stefan Sokolowski, I'll go with you.
Anywhere they send you, I'll find you, Rebecca Almozov.
Stay away from that.
There is a meeting tomorrow. You should come.
You got this color skin, and they don't let you in no more.
We all came to this new land on a promise. But the future has arrived, and the promise has not.
Your brother was very inspiring.
Yes, he likes to talk about rights. Just none for the women he knows.
Maybe there's someone who's brave enough to
forget try. About that Jewish girl in this strike.
She does not want to see you.
When love is truly blind.
Sokolowski, welcome to the revolution.
Worlds change one heart at a time.
Get the damn thing stopped and clear those troublemaking foreigners right out of the country.
They will crush you.
I will never forget about her or the strike.
The more we do nothing, the more nothing changes.
Hello, my name is Joanna Merwood-Salisbury, and I'm very happy to be speaking to you as part of the symposium series Rewriting Skyscraper History. My talk is about the meaning of the skyscraper for the early American labor movement. New York City, at the junction of Broadway and 14th Street, Union Square demonstrates a particularly significant conflation of skyscraper labor and skyscraper protest. The first Labor Day, September 16th, 1882, was organized by a kind of umbrella organization representing a huge number of unions in New York City in this time period, called the Central Labor Union. And it had a sort of twofold purpose. One was to be a rather benign labor holiday, a day when working people could take a vacation and celebrate all that they'd achieved. But it was also a demonstration of labor power. And because it was taking place in one of the most significant sites in the city, and it was very highly choreographed and well organized, it led to a huge amount of publicity and it became a tradition across the city and across the country. And of course now Labor Day is a public holiday. The Central Labor Union took advantage of a site that was relatively newly created, and that was the plaza at the northern end of Union Square. This was created by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux in 1872. They took what was a kind of oval landscaped park and cut off the top to create a sort of paved plaza area that they specifically intended for civic and public meetings. The image on the lower right is a Labor Day parade from 1887. So the plaza at Union Square wasn't designed for labor demonstrations and labor protests, but it very quickly became co-opted by the New York City unions, and through their very highly choreographed parades, they took ownership of it, and the square very quickly became associated with the labor movement. Into the later 19th century and the early 20th century, Labor Day was increasingly challenged by May Day, which is the International Socialist Day. And the events that were held at the plaza, seen here in 1908, were on May Day, at least of a more radical variety, kind of recalling the lakefront meetings in Chicago. This was a place of political activity, places where the anarchists and socialists could call for radical governmental reform, perhaps the overthrow of governmental democracy and its replacing with a kind of overt form of socialism. So Union Square in the late 19th century was increasingly associated with not a sort of benign labor solidarity, but more and more a kind of radical political activity. And there's a continual push and pull between the police and the city parks department and the unions as to what is a kind of an appropriate form of meeting in the square. The sort of right to free speech and the right to gather together is continually evoked as a way to protect this kind of activity. One of the most well-known, not to say notorious, figures to speak at Union Square in this period is the anarchist Emma Goldman. In 1893, she was arrested following a rally at the plaza in Union Square and charged with inciting a riot. She told the crowd that were gathered to listen to her that people who were starving should go to the homes of the wealthy on Fifth Avenue nearby and ask for bread, and if they were denied, that they should demand it by force. So that kind of language resulted in her being arrested and spending a year on Blackwell's Island. But she persisted in being a radical speaker and spoke many, many times in Union Square. And the image on the bottom right is her as an older woman in 1916 addressing a meeting of garment workers. So what you can see there is the cottage designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux as a kind of rostrum or speaking place, and the slightly more vernacular building on the right is actually a construction shed, because this was the period in which the subway lines were being installed underneath the park. The construction shed was housing the construction works. But the reason that I put that image in there is to introduce the idea of garment workers and how important Union Square became to the garment industry and also to the organization of garment workers around about the turn of the 20th century. So women had been visible in labor demonstrations in Union Square throughout the 1890s, not only through very high-profile figures like Emma Goldman, but members of socialist and labor groups. And this is a sort of a turning point for women's activism in public life. Working-class women were more and more present at these meetings, having a voice as legitimate members of the working class and arguing for their rights alongside the rights of male workers. But it's a particular class of female labour demonstrators that I want to talk about in particular. So Union Square, which began as a sort of residential area, was more and more commercial in the late 19th century, and certainly in the 1870s and 1880s it was associated with a sort of luxury goods trade. The Tiffany Building is the first and most prominent luxury goods building built around Union Square, soon followed by the domestic sewing machine building. Sewing machines were a luxury good, and this building was a place to demonstrate the sewing machine as something that the affluent could buy. As time went on, the Union Square became more and more associated with not only the showrooms of luxury goods manufacturers, but also with loft buildings built to house the offices of garment companies. Around about 1900, the loft buildings, which had traditionally been below 14th Street, places where garment companies would show their wares, although the actual goods were largely manufactured elsewhere in sweatshop buildings in the Lower East Side, started to be replaced by larger buildings described under the designation as lofts. And the two that you see here on the west side of Union Square, on the intersection with 14th Street, are the Lincoln Building, built in 1890, and the Spindler Building right next to it, built in 1896. These are both substantially larger than the buildings that existed in the square before that. You can see them towering up over the Tiffany Building on the right-hand side of the block. And they housed various different companies that manufactured different elements of women's clothing, domestic objects, anything that had to do with sewing and embroidery. And we know from the literature that, in fact, one particular company that had offices in the Spindler Building manufactured decorative art, needlework, draperies and silks, embroidered novelties, linens, plushes, and embroidery materials. And interestingly, even in this particular book, which was a guidebook to New York City businesses, it noted that they were made in the hot, humid atmosphere created by the latest in steam-powered machinery. So this quotation starts to suggest the very unpleasant working conditions that largely immigrant women workers were engaged with in these buildings. Soon after the Lincoln and the Spindler Building were built on the west side of Union Square, two, you can call them perhaps third generation loft buildings were built on the periphery of Union Square. One of them is the Everett Building on the northeast corner, which is still standing there today. It replaced the Everett Hotel. This was a kind of new generation loft building, even larger and more sophisticated than the loft buildings built around 1900. And it's initiated a whole generation of loft buildings north of Union Square. This particular building had offices and display rooms on its south side facing Union Square, and on the north side, where the daylight was better, it had space for manufacturing. And then directly across the street from it, the Germania Life Building was completed in 1911, which is also still there. So Germania Life was built for an insurance company, but it also included manufacturing space within it, sort of a hybrid loft and office building. So by 1911, Union Square is known as the center of the garment trade. All of these very substantial buildings are occupied not only by white collar workers, but also by female garment workers. And more these workers are starting to become involved in the labour movement, particularly after the formation of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, which was founded in 1900. This union supported a series of strikes from 1900 through to about 1916, just prior to the World War I period, in order to argue for better wages, better working conditions for their membership. Andrew Dolcutt has talked extensively about the effect of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911 on the way in which these loft buildings were thought about in terms of their safety in construction. But this very tragic event in which 146 garment workers were killed also served to strengthen the labour movement. Women joined the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in huge numbers following the fire, all in an effort to improve working conditions so that events like this wouldn't happen again. So here's a couple of images of garment workers in parades and demonstrations in Union Square from 1916 and 1917. On the image on the left-hand side, you can see the Everett Building in the background, and on the image on the right, you can see the Germania Life Building towering over the workers, and also the sort of sense of pride on the face of these women as they are parading through Union Square in a very highly visible phalanx with banners and sashes. And there's what you can't see in these images is that there would be music accompanying these parades. And these events were all very successful in improving working conditions for the women that were housed inside these buildings. And for a brief period, under the progressive government of New York City, Parks Commissioner Charles Stover and Police Commissioner Arthur Woods, Union Square was a sort of protected environment, recognized as a place of peaceable assembly, particularly for the working class, a place where they could make their case for better working conditions and for laws that protect them. That unfortunately started to unravel during World War II, when the sort of fears about labour activism came to the forefront again. But for a brief period, Union Square was sort of a unique conflation of skyscraper labour and successful skyscraper protest. So in this talk, I focused on the relationships between skyscraper labour and places of labour protest. In placing the skyscraper in the context of the history of a new kind of urban space, I want to argue that this building type has had an impact larger than its individual footprint. While the skyscraper skyline remains all around us, Union Square is the rare exception of an urban-scale memorial to the hugely important tradition of American labor protest. It's a tradition that won significant benefits for working people around 1900. Union Square stands as a memorial to the often overlooked skyscraper laborers who built the modern American city and who deserve a place in skyscraper history. Thank you.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1898. That was the day workers in the textile mills of New Bedford, Massachusetts, walked out on strike. They were organized along craft lines into five different unions. Regardless of craft, mill owners inflicted a 10% wage cut, which would prove devastating given the fact that whole families worked in the mills. When the wage cut took effect, spinners effectively shut down 22 mills owned by nine companies. Having formed an amalgamated strike committee, weavers, loom fixers, carders, and slasher tenders all stayed away in support. Workers' leaders like Samuel Gompers, Eugene V. Debs, and Daniel De Leon of the Socialist Labor Party all visited the strikers to give encouragement and inspiration. Debs alone acknowledged the role of women in the strike as workers, and not just as wives, mothers, daughters, or sisters. Before the strike, there had already been discord over strike demands. The weavers insisted on adding the fines issue. They constituted 40% of mill workers, and their job duties included correcting the mistakes of other trades. Manufacturers routinely fined weavers for material deemed imperfect, yet still profited from selling their products. The fine system wrought havoc on weaver families, and they wanted it abolished. The rest of the unions sympathized with their plight, but insisted the strike would fail unless they focused solely on the issue of wage cuts. The weavers persisted, and the demand stuck. By April, the strike collapsed. Workers went back with nothing gained. But the strike proved that workers across craft lines could strike and support each other in an industrial manner. It also proved that men and women workers could effectively organize a strike and picket together. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Of being seen as feeble and being scared in my hometown. When you don't count me among your equals, then don't expect me to just lie down. So now I'm gonna
that's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Today's music included the title track of the musical Stand, sung by Lisa Bell. And just a reminder, you can catch a free, that's right, free screening of Stand by the DC Labor Film Fest this Tuesday night. I'll be doing a live Q&A after the film with Danny Schur, the film's producer and composer, as well as the director of the film and one of the film's stars. We've got a link to RSVP in the podcast notes. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 80 labor radio and podcast shows. If you like Labor History Today, there's sure to be something else you like there. Check it out. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.